This is a Dreamcast disc and is for use only on a Dreamcast unit. Playing this disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers.
Dreamcast, up to 6 billion players.
Welcome back to the stage of history.
Why don't we play together?
Hey, it's time to make some crazy money. Are you ready? Here we go!
Please stop this disc now.
Segata-sanshiro!
Greetings, junkies. Welcome to the Dreamcast Junkyard Dream Pod. My name is Brian. I will be taking on hosting duties today, and I am joined by a suite of wonderful panelists and some esteemed guests of the community. But first, I'm joined by Lewis of the Junkyard. How are you doing, sir?
I am doing excellent, Brian. How are you?
Hanging in there, dealing with a bunch of moving stuff. I'm kind of in the middle of trying to get over to the UK to join you all, but turns out there's a lot of logistics involved. So,
yeah, I can imagine.
Working through all that. But today we are joined by the illustrious Sega Saturn Shiro, including Dave, a.k.a. Saturn Dave. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How you doing? I mean, you just told me.
No, that's my whole life right now.
I've been playing Earthbound, and I just made it to Foreside, so yeah, which is completely Saturn unrelated, but I'm having fun with that.
Nice. And then, Trino Co. As well. Thank you for joining us, Patrick. I don't know which one you like to go by these days.
Usually if it's on a cast, Patrick is fine. Trino Co. is sort of my stage name. Like it's like okay. Prince with the symbol. It's like the artist formerly known as Patrick.
Got it.
How I like to go nowadays.
Shoot, I know we used to have you on the Saturn Junkyard. You know, has the Titan Cast. We don't really record episodes very often for that at all.
Yeah, let me be honest though. Having me on is mostly me seeing you guys recording in Discord and hitting the join your call button and crowbarring my way into your podcast.
I don't think I've ever been on a Junkyard podcast.
Wait, seriously?
Seriously, unless we count the old mega collabs that we did for the New Year's.
Like those, I feel like the collabs were on Shiro, weren't they?
I think so, but I mean, we both posted them, I think.
Yeah,
so,
speaking though, Dave has been on your podcast, just was on the syndicated one when we both released the mega cast.
Right, yeah. But I've never been on like a proper Junkyard cast. So here you go.
Yeah, well, welcome to this one.
It's been a long time coming to get you guys on the show. I think me and Patrick have discussed it for like multiple years now, so I'm glad to finally have you guys on.
Dude, no, it's even worse. The baton was passed between Tom.
Oh yeah,
and then it went to you. It's like Tom's like, oh, we'll get you on, we'll get you on, mate, and then it's like, okay,
we'll get you on, mate.
I had Facebook messages where you said we're gonna get you on, mate, and it's like it passed the Lewis, and it's like, oh gosh, we'll get on. I'll get on eventually. It's all good.
Oh, happy to have you anyway.
Seen it before, but I love the Dreamcast Junkyard. It's one of the biggest inspirations for why Dave and I started Shiro. And we started off, I think it was one of my favorite podcasts. I listened all the way back in, I think it's 2015. Some of my favorite hosts, I really miss hearing, like, I forgot his name, the one American that was on there. I forgot what his name was. He, my favorite, and I don't remember his name. But he was on there a lot. I really liked him.
We'll have AI
figure it
generate out. Generate his voice again.
Yeah. I mean, well, it is interesting just because this podcast goes through. I mean, this is the first time I think I've done hosting. So, you know, we just have a cycle of a bunch of people who have a lot of different interests and approaches to the Dreamcast scene that all have their own specific niches and interests. And I think it kind of culminates in a cycle of rotating cast that, I think it's kind of fun. Episodes just end up being so different. Yeah.
It is. It's different personalities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I loved hearing like you come on the podcast. I love hearing Lewis. I loved all the ones. I loved, like Mike. I know Mike Phelan was on a little bit. I think he jumps on from time to time still. But there's just a lot of different people that have come and gone on the podcast, and that's why I like it. It's a different views, different personalities, different philosophies, which I really appreciate about the podcast, and it's been fun. Oh my God, it's almost 10 years since you guys have been recording these podcasts. It's kind of insane to think about, really.
Yeah, it's 2015, right?
Yeah,
beginning of 2015, I remember I was like, I think I popped in like in the fall of 2015, and it was like, I think it was like 7 or 8 episodes in.
I thought that Dreamcast Junkyard was older than that.
It is, yeah.
Well, the site is, but not the podcast.
2005.
Yeah. But not the podcast? Oh, okay. What was I listening to before that? I don't know. It just seems like it's a lot older than that. That's funny.
There's the Maximum Power podcast, I think Tom did. Maybe that's what you were listening to.
Oh, that might have been it. Yeah, because I do remember Tom, and he would talk a lot about the Jaguar.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, okay. All right. That's probably what it was. And there was also Back in My Play. There's been a bunch of great podcasts over the years that have like come and gone, you know?
Yeah. That was what, Kevin Larrabee? That's a great podcast.
Yeah. So many that have come and gone though, you know, like doing it for this long, long as you guys have done and still keeping it going, there's something to be commended there, you know?
I mean, it's easier to do when it's, you know, with the cycling.
Staff, passing the torch.
I mean, I think we just have some, and even on the blog, right, you have people from the community stepping in and helping. I think what Pizza Hotline and Laws, and they've been really involved, and it's just kind of a good time. It's almost like a party.
We're almost sitting there too. We've started 17, and honestly, even though it feels like it's been so long, it feels like we just started. Like, like we started when you guys were 2 years old, and it's like the podcast is 2 years old, and it's, I don't know, it feels like we're just starting right now. Like, I don't think we've even reached the midway point of doing these podcasts, and I feel like for both of us, it's the same way. I think we still have a lot that we have to say that's not been said, and it's just crazy how it feels that that even after all this time, we still got so much we got to talk about. It's insane.
And there's always new stuff, right? I mean, that's kind of the impetus for a lot of the material that both Shiro and Dreamcast Junkyard focus on today, is all the new developments of the community that are kind of driving it forward. Like, maybe we can just start with a little softball question, and then I think we'll go a little bit more into who you are and what you're actually doing here. safe to say we're a Dreamcast focused podcast, more or less. You all are more Saturn focused, obviously, it's in the name, taking a step back, those consoles are now what, 25 years old at the earliest?
Jeez, 30 for Saturn.
Saturn's pushing 30, Dreamcast, 25. Crazy.
And so there's, in the interim since then, we've seen several video game generations come and go. And Sega, of course, has been fairly involved in continuing to produce games for it through highs and lows of its own. But with that, what are... and we'll just go around the table here, but what's your favorite Sega game from after the Saturn and Dreamcast era?
You want to go first, Pat?
So that one's hard. For Sega, there's a lot of good options. There's, of course, Soccer Wars, So Long My Love, which is an amazing, amazing PS2 RPG. There's also the crossover games with all those other companies, like... what was it called? The Project X Zone. Yeah, those ones. Right. Muy bueno. There's just so many. Sonic Battle was so good. Specifically Sonic Battle. But honestly, there's just so many good options. If I had to choose one, though, and this is going to be kind of cheating, but it's only because I play it so much, is F-Zero GX.
Oh, yeah, that is a Sega game.
I don't think
right?
that's cheating. That's, yeah, dude, that's a solid choice.
You stole my game.
See, everyone loves F-Zero. But yeah, like the thing is that I think as much as I like F-Zero X, I think GX just took it to another level. And the fact that even now people are like, you don't even have to like, don't even have to modify, just HD release. It's perfect. It's like, mm-hmm. that shows how well that game has held over.
The best Nintendo game is actually a Sega game, right? You yeah. know,
Sega does what Nintendo yeah. and Sega it's is good true. At making Nintendo's properties. I mean, not saying F-Zero X sucked, but like make it amazing, you know?
Well, F-Zero was always a very arcadey type racer, and Sega knows their shit when it comes to making arcade games, right? Like yeah. nobody does it better.
You know what? Like my friend who, you know, he's not really like big into consoles, but he had a GameCube and he had that game. And, you know, whenever I tell him about, you know, all the stuff with Dreamcast and like, I love Sega and all this, he'd always go, oh, I know a good Sega game. And that was his game. I never knew it was a Sega game until he said that. So, yeah, mm-hmm. I need to check it out, to be honest. It's a bit of a crime that I've not played it yet.
That is a crime. You lose your license. No, I'm just kidding.
You lost your machine.
License revoked. No, I'm kidding. You really do have to test it. I mean, that's a bliss game. That's like one of those games oh, yeah. where you fire it up and you're like, wow, this is a video game. Yeah. This fills me with all sorts of adrenaline and just happy vibes. Like, it's just that good, you know? Mm-hmm. And not all games are like that.
No, there's so many fun ways to play, especially with the... Like the one stage where there's no edges, you have to not fall off. Me and my friends play it where we have to do four player, and yeah. our stipulation is that we have to beat the level together, and we cannot, if we fall off, we have to restart the entire thing again.
Nice.
And it's so much fun.
You get so hyped on that game. I'm going to go in a different direction then because Pat stole my game.
Sorry, Kane.
So, this is a safe answer. I'm going to say Sonic Mania. And I say that because, you know, it's a throwback to what we loved about, you know, Sonic in the 16-bit era, but it also brings in the scene, you know, it brings in, you know, the fans, you know, and it took fans to get that game made, right? So I think that that's really important, you know, because we're all about the community nowadays, and we're all about all the cool stuff that fans are doing, because, I mean, Sega wouldn't be Sega nowadays if it wasn't for the fans, you know,
yeah.
standing up and kind of like filling the void, you know? So yeah, I'm going to go Sonic Mania. I think it's great. It may not be the best Sonic game ever, but it's a really good Sonic game. And I enjoy it on almost any platform. So yeah, I'm going to go Sonic Mania.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good choice.
It's a safe choice.
And it was kind of funny seeing, you know, Christian Whitehead's progression starting to do, because he started off with a fan homebrew Sonic game.
Absolutely,
right? Isn't that how he yeah. kind of mm-hmm. got Sega's attention?
And I mean, the Sonic fan game scene is like an entire black hole that you could fall into. Of its, you know, like every year, the amount of submissions to that is just crazy, and there's so much good stuff out there. Like we know Sonic Mania because it reached the mainstream, but oh my god, there's so much good stuff out there being done that folks don't know about. It's just crazy.
Yeah. Even that little demo for that Voxel did for Sonic Extreme was just amazingly yeah. fun.
The Z-Stream.
But I mean, it's just the tip of the iceberg.
Z-Treme.
Well, Z-Treme was actually XL2, but Voxel went ahead and he just full-blown made Sonic Extreme, you know, with all the ripped assets from that original build. Yeah, he went ahead yeah. and built it and then ported it to Saturn. And I mean, arguably, it's you could see why it wasn't released, you know, because as a game, it's not. But as an interesting tech demo and stuff like that, you know, it's definitely it's amazing though.
But yeah, I really enjoyed like games like that. And I'm glad that the Sonic community is able to put out stuff like that, and you know, satiate the community.
But I want to see more. I want to see more from Sega, you know, and hopefully we're on the precipice of
a new
direction for them. I'm hoping. I have my fingers crossed.
I mean, yeah, I go back and forth on this. I mean, sometimes it's like, yeah, it'd be great that, you know, to see more official revivals of these things, but you know, I'm always reminding myself that the Sega today just the Sega that we grew up with and that mm-hmm. we hold up mm-hmm. now just doesn't exist in the same way as it did prior.
Sure.
And fans really have taken the mantle in a lot of ways. And so maybe there's opportunities to build, you know, those, maybe elevate some of the fan projects mm-hmm. and those and people currently doing the work, like a Christian Whitehead originally, where sure. they can, you know, license those games. I mean, C Smash VRS is another one that came out earlier, which is a VR mm-hmm. reimagining of
Cosmic Smash.
Yeah, Cosmic Smash. And that was, you know, and that was one that I think Jorg had a story about just trying to hammer back and forth with Sega's legal team and other personnel to try to get that license. And they, half of them probably didn't even remember what it was, right? but I guess the idea of having a more structured pipeline where Sega can kind of offload some of those licenses to more talented or very, you know, passionate and talented developers within the community, that almost is a win-win in that Sega doesn't have to build up its own internal teams to facilitate those projects. But maybe there's trade-offs no matter what, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, to me, I think the sixth gen, to me, is probably the perfect era for games because it was the time when big AAA companies were experimenting with crazy, crazy game designs. I mean, you had Xbox just throwing everything at the wall, trying to get something to stick with their weird ones. They had PlayStation releasing all the crazy RPGs and games like, you know, the Mosquito one, all these like weird
Mr. Mosquito,
stuff like that. Like all these weird ones. And of course the GameCube, which I think is honestly a lot of people say Xbox is Dreamcast too. I disagree. GameCube is Dreamcast too.
Yes, Patrick is on the money. That is what I agree with that 100%.
I think collectively, they probably were. I mean, Xbox got a lot of the original games that were, you know, in development for Dreamcast that ended up being, you know, ported over to a system that was going to be, they would be able to release in to be marketable. But then I think the, you know, PS2, of course, got Virtua Fighter 4 and a number of games on that front. GameCube really got some awesome stuff just with all of the re-releases of, you know, Skies of Arcadia Legends and PSO.
Sonic Adventure 1 and 2.
Came out on Xbox as well. Yeah, Sonic Adventure 2 Battle. And so, like, there were, like, very different types of projects that went to each platform. And, of course, Monkey Ball was classic, and that ended up releasing on all of them with the deluxe version.
Absolutely. Technically, that's technically a Dreamcast port if you think about it, but not really, but technically. Well,
yeah, I guess Naomi Arcade, right?
Yeah, so technically speaking, another Dreamcast port. But yeah, I think my the reason for the Dreamcast 2 thing is that I feel like the GameCube had everything that I feel would make a Dreamcast 2. Like, it had the weird Resident Evil exclusives. Mm-hmm. It had the, you know, the weird, bizarre games and cel-shaded games like Killer 7.
Like Product Number 3.
Piano 3, I was just going to say.
Oh, weird stuff like that.
The bongos, that feels like a very Dreamcast peripheral.
Yeah, there is a lot of DNA there.
Yeah, no, certainly.
But then again, that doesn't surprise me because Nintendo and Sega were more alike than you know, arguably PlayStation or Xbox, you know. Like, they're very old-school game companies.
What if GameCube was a successor to the Dreamcast for the reasons that you just said, but the Xbox was actually the successor to the Saturn for all of the continuation of, you mm-hmm. know, Panzer Dragoon and a lot and Outrun 2 and all of the games that kind of continued some of that lineage?
I can definitely see that, and like, I wouldn't mind that because I think, I mean, I love the Xbox. Well, I mean, not as much, but I mean, honestly, Halo really is one of my favorite like games of all time. Like, just I put so many hours into that game, but yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say, but yeah, I guess I could see that because I think there wasn't as much for the Xbox, but for what they had, whereas there's a lot of really heavy hitters.
I mean, you had Jet Set Radio. You had Jet Set Radio Future, right? Yeah. You had some stuff, you know.
Crazy Taxi 3, yeah.
Steel Battalion with the weird giant controller.
Wasn't there a Yakuza on the...
That was on original PS2, Xbox? I think.
No, that was PS2. Yeah, just PS2. Okay, yeah. So I don't know.
All got some good stuff.
That's what happened when Sega was dismantled, basically. You know, it just kind of.
And that's why I think the sixth gen, in my opinion, I think is the best gen because you had not only the power of the Dreamcast, which I can cheat into, thank you, Sega, but also all the other great consoles. And, like, I don't know, like, if I had to be stuck in one gen and never, like, move consoles, I think I could play the sixth gen. Yeah. And be happy the rest of my life. Absolutely. There's so much.
I would stay with the fifth gen, honestly. But that's, yeah. I guess, okay, so you're making the argument based on the software itself, right? But I always say, like, you know, I think we're all old enough to kind of remember the fifth gen, and never was there a time in the gaming industry where so much change was happening and where, I don't know, it was just such an exciting time as a gamer, the fifth generation.
Yeah, and I could see that. Because there's definitely a lot more experimentation, that because they didn't know what would stick. But I think my thing with the sixth gen is that I think they did that experimenting. They were able to experiment into deeper gameplay mm-hmm. things, not have to worry about, oh, how can we move the camera, or oh, how can we render this? It's always going to be,
yeah.
And they still look good now.
Yeah, the sixth generation was the beginning of the gaming industry settling into what it is now. You know, basically like very large, like corporate projects. I just feel like, yeah, it kind of settled into what it was going to be moving forward, you know. But in the fifth gen, it was still really exciting because the dust had not settled yet, and nobody knew who, you know, how things were going to shake out, basically, you know. So for me, it was a time where like anything could happen, you know, anything was possible. And I don't know, maybe I sound like an old guy, but
no, I definitely see it from your perspective. I definitely agree that there's plus and minuses.
But no, you're absolutely right, Pat. I mean, like the PS2, for example, like I'm a huge Sega fan, but that doesn't mean I hate on PS2. I think it's arguably one of the best consoles of all time with an amazing library, and there's so many good games on it. So, I mean, yeah, from a software standpoint, you would be eating good to have that selection between, you know, PS2, Xbox, GameCube, and Dreamcast.
Lewis, what's your favorite game that you'd like to add here?
I do want to shout out Patrick for the Sonic Battle suggestion. If you mean the GBA one, right?
Because yeah,
that game is sick. I had that as a kid.
That game is a silent, that's a sleeper hit.
Definitely.
Like, people sleep on that game. That game, honestly, there's so many fun mechanics. There's so much. There's honestly, the story is even pretty good too.
Yeah,
like that whole story with the dude. Like that, the story is really solid.
He's like the robot, isn't it? Who needs like you copy other characters' moves and make the best robot. It's like, yeah, it's great. But I mean, it's already been mentioned. Jet Set Radio Future is undoubtedly like, I don't know if it's been topped in my eyes as far as like Sega's post Dreamcast output, but like, I actually, controversially, I possibly think gameplay-wise, Jet Set Radio Future is maybe better than the first one. The only bit that's kind of a letdown is the way that it simplifies the graffiti. Like, it's just you go up to it and you click a button and he does it. Whereas there was that kind of urgency of like the original, where it's like, you know, I better get this done before the police grab me. And there's that kind of battle to kind of do it before they get you. So that was a little bit of a letdown, but mostly like just the handling and like, maybe the graphical style is a little bit sort of darker, and I wasn't quite as keen on that. But like, as far as enjoying it gameplay wise, I did appreciate what they improved there.
Same,
yeah, absolutely.
There were some refinements for sure. Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, I totally agree. I was playing Future just a couple of months ago, and I'm pretty surprised at how well it's held up. Yeah, especially, you know, side by side with Bomb Rush Cyberpunk, the homage project that released this year or last year, which borrowed pretty heavily from Jet Set Radio Future in hindsight. But
I think
it's still really good.
Yeah, what's your pick then, Brian?
Oh, geez. I mean, this is going to be another cop-out, but I would say the Yakuza series or Like a Dragon series wholesale. I just started playing Infinite Wealth.
Is that the new name of the series, Like a Dragon? I was not clear on that.
Yeah, it was originally Like a Dragon in Japan, Ryoga Gotoku or whatever.
Is that what Yakuza was known as?
Yeah, that's what it was known as in Japan, and then they finally just kind of aligned the project names.
Okay. Well, that's funny. I actually was salty because, like, dang, I actually like the Yakuza name, but I mean, technically, it's like, well, if it's Word of God, it's the original title, then let's go with it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a retconning of sorts.
It's like with Dragon Quest and Dragon Warrior.
Yeah, I was gonna say Dragon Quest and Dragon Warrior. Yeah, so I'm fine with it, as long as it's like that, you know, it's like the same in line.
Yeah, it just does a lot of things that scratch the itches I generally have for just a well-made, compelling game. I mean, even aside from the over-the-top, you know, crime drama narrative, it's a very melodramatic, but there's just so much charm through every you know, character, every side quest, every just random scenario you come across that kind of enriches the very dense environments that you hang out in, and you spend a lot of time in these places over the course of the games. You know, a lot of them have been set in the same handful of places, and so you just kind of learn to kind of love those as a character too, and appreciate how those evolve game to game, in addition to the plights and tribulations of the characters themselves. But yeah, they're always trying to experiment a little bit, RGG Studio, with obviously switching the game starting with Yakuza 7 or the original, or Like a Dragon here, to turn-based combat, and adding, you know, way different types of mechanics and mini games that always cycle in and out through each entry, and kind of help define them in some capacity. There's just a lot there that is continuously keeping it fresh, and they're just so much fun to go back to and to follow along as the series progresses. And of course the beat 'em up style gameplay with Kazuma Kiryu is a huge fan favorite. And I think just as a whole, all of the,
it's all about Majima
things,
my dude.
Yeah. I mean, Majima, of course, can't forget Majima. But yeah, anyway, even though I had to overpay to get him in the DLC for my, Dendoku Island, which I'm a little annoyed about.
Yeah, honestly, I'm pretty upset with the whole DLC handling of the new Yakuza game. $15 to play a new game plus? You gotta be kidding me.
But there is a Ryo Hazuki Easter egg, though, like a Shenmue Easter egg. Yeah, you have to find it on YouTube. There's a bit where you're walking around and like the guy with you is talking about how he met this guy in Japan and he was looking for sailors. It's great. You'll have to check it out.
It is funny, though, because technically, Yakuza was a spiritual successor to Shenmue, I think that's really funny. Cool full circle thing.
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I guess it kind of hits some of that virtual tourism bit. But I do feel like it varies starkly as far as the type of experience it is, where it's a more player-centric, where like it feels like the world revolves around the player more than the player is just a inhabiting the world, as I kind of feel Shenmue is a little more different in how it handles its density, and then the feeling that more is just, it would be, you know, that those communities would continue to exist whether Ryo was there or not. I don't necessarily feel the same of Yakuza, and I don't think that's a value judgment. I think it's just where those approaches differ significantly, where, you know, Kiryu and Ichiban are kind of given these sandboxes to do what they want with in these dense cities that have all sorts of cool stuff that seemingly exists just for their for their amusement.
Yeah,
and I feel that Yakuza doesn't take itself as seriously as Shenmue. Not saying that Shenmue can't be silly, but I feel like Yakuza specifically, like, yeah, we're just gonna get crazy with it, whatever.
Yeah,
like they don't care.
Yeah,
I'd probably rather play Yakuza than Shenmue.
That's just blasphemy.
Yeah. Me and Dave are on the same side.
I would rather play Shenmue.
I mean, at least I can finish my story.
Oh, okay. You went there. But you know what? Yeah. I'd rather play Shenmue than a lot of games, honestly. Shenmue.
Shenmue was so formative for me as far as getting me to reconsider what games could do and how we could engage with them, and that they weren't necessarily something that was just about pure fighting or platforming. You know, it gave us so many weird verbs that were grounded in the mundanity in a way.
It's not just a game, though. It's a vibe.
Yeah,
you
exactly.
You know what I mean? And that, it's like when you want that vibe, you know, just like PSO is a vibe, you know, like, and I feel that way about so many Sega games. It's like you can just slip into that comfortable world. I'm not saying that Yakuza isn't. I'm not saying that it doesn't have those qualities, but I'm just saying, like, there's a visual, an emotional, I don't know, oral, I don't know. There's a language, almost like, I don't know. It folks, I have a hard time articulating these things, but all I can say is Shenmue is kind of like not like many other things, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like maybe new eyes, new fresh eyes that come to it nowadays may not see that, or it may be completely lost on them because they take that for granted and they've experienced so many things that have come after it that have been influenced by it. Mm-hmm. But to me, it's just like, it takes me straight back to like this feeling that I had when I played it. And I can still get that just walking around, you know, Yokosuka and the harbor. And I don't know. It's something special. I feel that way about a lot of Sega games.
Yeah. And the good thing about Shenmue though, is that you can play it regularly now. You don't have to buy a Dreamcast and hope the disc isn't broken on one of them. And hopefully it loads. You can literally right now, you just pause this podcast, go buy it on Steam and play through 1-3. And I think that's what I like most about it, is that now it's so accessible that people can try it out and see for themselves what it was like and what it's like.
But you don't have to pause the podcast. You can just have it playing in the background. It's like one of those kind of games sometimes.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about this. This isn't a video podcast. Yeah, do that instead.
There's this guy on YouTube, Joseph Kitchen Fried Noodles. Have you guys seen that channel? Joseph Kitchen.
Is he related to George Kitchen, who did that fan game recently? Or is it just a coincidence that they have that
similar I don't know. I just found him by chance, and I don't know how I've slept on him for all these years, but he takes like the Shenmue, all the Shenmue assets and the engine and everything like that, and he's able to like build out stories about each of the characters.
Oh, nice.
Oh my God, he's like, there's this one Shenmue story episode 11, Kazumi Minowa, the sailor, and it's like his whole story after their whole scheme went belly up, you know, and Ryo came in and like kicked everybody's ass, you know. It like follows his story after the fact, and it's so good. Like it looks like it's being played in the Shenmue game engine.
Nice. I'll have to check that one out.
You got to check it out, and I will share it with you guys. It's a blast. The entire channel is just amazing. But he recently posted a video showing what he has to do to rebuild and create these things, and it's insane. The level of like dedication he puts into each one of these videos, it's incredible.
I think we've kind of focused on the post-Sega hardware era of the company at this point. Let's go back in time a bit and talk about what you all focus on as Shiro in the Saturn scene. So I guess I could just start by saying, you know, what's your pitch? How would you describe what Shiro does? Jeez. Sorry, my dog's name is Shio, so...
Well,
that's cute.
Your dog is cute, so I have to say that.
Yeah. You're forgiven.
How did you guys all meet, and how did it happen?
Basically, I think the first time we met, I put a picture online that I wanted to recreate the Police Knots original cover for the Saturn, the one that was teased in the magazine, and I did some research and looked around, and apparently it's like this picture in this art book. Like, the cover was going to look really bad. It's like some random picture of like the Police Knots suit.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, I'm trying to recreate this. Anyone give me feedback? And the Dave messaged me. He's like, hey, yeah, let me clean up a little bit in Photoshop and I can give it back to you. And it's like, cool, mm-hmm. thanks, Dave. And we just kept talking and talking. And I said, hey, I think I listened to this podcast. Like, maybe I should do a podcast with Saturn. I was like, hey, Dave, do you want to do a podcast about Saturn? And then it's like, yeah, sure. Do we need a third? And we reached out to, who's the other guy we tried to reach out to? But he said no. He was like the Collectors of America dude.
Oh, did we reach out to the guy who owned the group?
Yeah.
I can't even remember. Yeah, he was like, no, not interested.
Yeah, he said, not interested, and we went with Kay Conan's anyways, so instead.
Which is funny, because he was a dude that I was like arguing with in the Facebook group at the time, and now, of course, we're really good friends, but
yeah, we all, it's just funny. I think both me and him argued about it. I was like, that dude? And it's like, ended up being a pretty cool dude and a really great friend. So,
yeah, you know, it's funny, if I may just go a little farther back. I think that as gamers, especially as retro gamers, like we all kind of go through like these seasons of individual consoles, right? Mm. And I think at that, like I had a 10-year love affair with the Dreamcast, right? Where it was just like everything, eat, sleep, Dreamcast, you know? And so, and I'm not saying that I'm still not in love with the Dreamcast. It's just like Saturn was my first love, basically. It's like the one that I always go back to. Mm-hmm. And I think that every gamer has that, you know? I think that that exists for every gamer. But that doesn't mean that you don't have like these like really intense periods in your life where you just are really, you know, exploring every facet of a certain console. And I had just gotten kind of finished with the DS, like kind of on the downhill slope of like really going deep with the Nintendo DS. And I was like looking for something else. And I was like getting back into Saturn, you know, I was like, okay, well, this is like the console I keep going back to, because it was the one that I just loved the most when I was a kid. But it was like 2015, and I swear, like the prices online were ridiculous. I already knew they were ridiculous, and several times I had thought to myself, like, should I start collecting for Saturn? No, I can't.
$400 for Panzer Dragoon Saga? That's way too much money.
But I mean, even regular games like Sonic R, you know, like so Sonic R was the first game that I picked up in 2015 when I started getting back into collecting Saturn again. So not, you know, of course I had all the games that I had kept from my childhood, but like this, it was the first one that I got, and I picked it up on eBay disc only. Right. And even disc only, it was like kind of ridiculously expensive, at least as far as I was concerned in comparison. And I was just like, but then as soon as I got it disc only, I was kind of like disappointed, because I was like, oh, I wish I had the box and the manual and everything like that. And okay, now I got to go. Now I'm going to try to buy another, you know, a long box Saturn game, you know? And when I got it, then it like just hit that. It just started me on this like crazy trip of like picking up a bunch of long box Saturn games.
Yeah.
And, you know, long story short, I ended up on this, you know, Sega Saturn Collectors of America group, and Pat was there. And we both like a lot of the same stuff. We like the same music. We love Kojima games. We love, you know, just a lot of the same. So we both love Dreamcast. And yeah, Pat actually reached out to me for whatever reason. he thought that I would be a good, he had faith that I'd be a good partner for a podcast.
Well, it helped we talked for like forever, and like we this talked like true. We were like on a first date, like, you know, when you message the girl and you're just talking nonstop. It was like me and Dave, like I just stop and text him.
Which I don't really do typically. Yeah. Like I don't chat with strangers online, but I don't know, for whatever reason. Yeah, we had a really long conversation. And yeah, then a few weeks later, he's like, you want to start a podcast? I was like, sure. You know, because for me, like at that time, I was really needing community. I was really needing like folks that I could share the love of this console with, you know, to kind of complement my journey of like picking up games and stuff like that. And yeah, you know, I had so many thoughts, so many things that I wanted to say about the games. And it's like, how do I verbalize that? How do I get it out there? You know, I think that as we get older, we start to get more introspective, and we start to kind of like, it's not just about playing the games anymore. It's about like exploring every facet of the console and kind of squeezing every last ounce of blood from that turnip, you know, but you learn more about yourself, you know, you learn more about like what you like about games and why you love this console so much. So yeah, it was fun. We started a podcast in August of 2017, and it was pretty much downhill from there.
Yeah. I think our first episode I was looking at aired September 9th, 2017. So, right. It's actually on my best friend's birthday and the release of the Beatles Rock Band. So
nice.
Too great.
Nothing else.
And at first we were just, we didn't even know what to call ourselves. So the first episode was like a Saturn podcast or a Saturn cast or something.
We just called it like Saturn cast. I had no idea what to call it.
And Kay was like, we should call it Sega Saturn Shiro, you know, which means you must play Sega Saturn. And I didn't at the time, I wasn't familiar with the campaign. Like I knew who Sagato was, but I wasn't familiar with that catchphrase, you know, Sega Saturn Shiro, which basically is an imperative. It also Shiro also means white because it was they launched that campaign with the white Saturn. So Shiro means white. It also means fortress, you know, powerful, like strong fortress. It means do. It's like it's an imperative. You must do. Yeah. You know, so it's all of those things, you know.
So double entendre of sorts.
So like,
exactly.
So was it just the podcast originally? Did the site come later and everything else?
Site came 2018. The site came in 2018. Yeah, it was just a podcast. And
okay.
It was one of those listicle kind of things where it was like 10, we're going to cover like 10 or 20 games, you know. There would be like a 3-hour episode and we'd barely get to, we'd gloss over each game because we didn't have much time to like really dive in and talk about each game. But it would be like, okay, here's a bunch of vertical shooters, or here's a bunch of Neo Geo games on Saturn, you know. Those kind of things. Funny enough, like a month after we, and probably simultaneous at the very same time that we were brewing up the whole Shiro thing and trying to start a podcast, there was this Southern boy over in Louisiana who was, you know, also going through the exact same thing and, you know, having this itch to like talk about these games and stuff like that. And he hooked up with Brian here and started the Saturn Titan Cast, which was a part of the Saturn Junkyard. It's so funny that those almost happened like a month apart. So, cause I believe it was like October or November of 2017 that you guys published your first episode.
Yeah, I want to say it was October, but
apart.
And it was kind of funny. It was coming on the heels of Simon, who was the founder of he was originally on the Dreamcast Junkyard, part of that crew, got Tom's blessing to create a Saturn version of it. And then I think John Lee was also involved in basically resuscitating or rebuilding the community as a Facebook group and a variety of other things they were experimenting with. Nuno had come from, he had done some stuff back in the original heyday of Saturn Junkyard on the blog, and then he was part of it trying to do some of the YouTube stuff. Just kind of, we were all in that group, the new newly formed group at that time, and I think Simon and Sam decided to get a group together for the podcast, and so Nuno and I kind of hopped on board at that point.
It was such a coincidence, though, because I always wondered to myself, like, if that had happened a month earlier, would Pat and I have just joined you guys, you know, rather than starting our own thing? Because we were both like, it's one of those things where I think we were both doing this like completely separate from each other, but on the same wavelength. You know what I mean? And and I, you know, if you guys would have hit like, because literally Pat said to me, nobody else is doing a Saturn podcast. And so we were like, yeah, you're right. Only there's the Dreamcast Junkyard and they do a great Dreamcast podcast, but nobody is giving the Saturn any love. So we did that. And then like a month later, the Titancast hit and I was like, wow.
Yeah,
that is crazy.
The Sega Saturn fans were eating in those 2 months, weren't they, with the two podcasts?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. No, they still are, dude. Like it's just insane. Yeah. Like, literally, it's like there's just such been a waterfall since both of our casts dropped. And honestly, though, going back to what Dave says about if that released a month earlier, I would have told Dave, let's do a Neo Geo podcast instead.
Nice.
Right? That was like the second episode we did was like Neo Geo games on the Saturn. Because, you know, Pat and I are both huge Neo Geo fans.
Yeah, so I would have 1,000% done a Neo Geo podcast. And I'd probably be covered in Neo Geo hardware, Neo Geo AES, MVS stuff. I would probably not be doing Warhammer because...
Your wallet would be empty.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I just have less hobbies. I'd have to do all that Neo Geo.
I mean, if people think the Saturn is expensive, you know... Come on.
The Neo Geo, you're crying right now. There's this guy, I don't know if you guys know his name, Steve Wright Jr. I think Brian knows him.
Yeah,
well.
I've met him at PRGE, I think.
Yeah, this guy's gone through a Saturn U.S. Saturn collection long box twice. He's doing a Neo Geo AES collection right now, and I'm like, oh, all right, good luck to you, man. Props on that. Like, that's like,
And then once he gets them off, he'll sell them off. Right, that's the party trick.
So he sold it once and then like got them again. Wow.
He acquired the US Longbox collection twice and sold it twice. It's performance art, basically. That he was even totally straight up about it. He's like, it's not for me, it's just the thrill of the hunt. It's picking it up, sharing it along the way, posting about it, and then selling it. Cause it's less so about, like, I'm sure that he has a console that is like his console, right? But when it comes to this, it's like, that's the performance art, is like picking up this collection as like a major feat, you know? He's in a position to do it. So, you know, there you go.
Yeah. And I'm not dunking on him. I really enjoy it just because it's just fascinating. Like,
in fact, I respect the fact that he's putting it back out there. You know,
yeah.
For so he's not just picking up and hoarding it. Like he's admits that he has no specific interest in these games, you know, but he's more interested in like picking up this collection and seeing, proving that he can do it. And then he puts it back out there and, you know, other folks are able to pick up those games. So he did a whole cast with us about it. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah. The things that he traveled with the WWE and he took a bunch of photos. So he had a lot of access to going to different game stores across the country at one point. I think he's not doing that anymore. I think he's doing YouTube full time. So I think he is mostly based in Texas. So I think there's just a lot of stuff in there. And he goes to a lot of cons. Honestly, I kind of want to pick his brain again. I find him really fascinating, and he's a really interesting dude. So I think it'd be really interesting to pick him.
A lot of it is trades, too.
Yeah.
You know, just having stuff to be able to trade, you know. That's the hard thing for me. Everybody asks, like, would you be interested in trading? I'm like, I don't have any extra of anything. Like, I don't have anything I want.
I'm not giving away my Pokemon games. I don't know. I really wish I had his mentality. Like, I'm too connected to anything. Like, I don't want to give away any of my Dreamcast stuff. I don't want to trade any of my Pokemon box games. Even though it's like I don't touch them, it's like I want my 80 Dreamcast games. Mm-hmm. Leave me alone. Let me have my Dreamcast.
I also think it's a testament to all the different unique and interesting ways people engage with the hobby, right? Like, we're all after different stuff out of this. Some of it is the thrill of the hunt. And I think maybe in that case, it's kind of the extreme version of that, whereas some people are happy with just emulating everything, which I'm going to get used to doing as I move and don't have much space to. I'm not bringing my collection with me. And then, you know, everybody else kind of falls somewhere in between. In addition to just all the other ways that people engage with Saturn and Dreamcast on a technical level through homebrews and mods and or retrospective, or just like people like me who are trying to find new things to appreciate about all the stuff that we missed over the years. But given that, since your founding as Shiro, you all have kind of spiraled up a few projects to kind of attack the scene a few different ways in that regard. And so tell us a little bit about, the types of projects and other people who are on your crew who are, what's under the Shiro umbrella right now?
Sure. Well, I mean, so it was Pat, me and Kay for several months, maybe over a year, doing the podcast. And then we onboarded a couple more folks. We brought Ben Wallace on board to help with some tech stuff and also, you know, be a member of the co-host of the cast, as well as Peter Malik. And Peter is a brilliant writer. You know, like, I mean, I can't sing his praises enough. Like, I think that he's a brilliant writer and he's a diehard Sega fan, especially Saturn, but just everything Sega. And, you know, he's from Canada. He has a lot of great insights about things, and he's not one to ever half-ass anything. You know, he goes all in, he deep dives games and just like squeezes every ounce of enjoyment about it and then writes about it. And so, you know, I was really happy. That's kind of where the site started, was with, you know, giving Peter a platform to be able to write like long form editorial, you know?
Yeah.
And then, you know, maybe a place to share out the cast and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it really just started kind of like a blog. Maybe we were influenced. It's fair to say maybe we were influenced by the Junkyard and what they do, you know, because they are also a blog, right? You know, so it seemed like the thing to do, to start a blog to complement the YouTube or the Podbean or whatever.
I think we just wanted a place just to put our podcast initially in it.
Yeah,
a
place to put our stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah, because I think Peter was the writer, and we just want somewhere that, because, I mean, Peter, we always see him post on Facebook these long articles. And
that's what it was. That's what it was. Facebook. So, like, we were putting so many eggs into the Facebook basket, which admittedly is a walled garden, right? You know, like, there's a lot of, as we would go along, we would discover that a lot of people would share something and be like, sorry, I don't have Facebook, or I'm not a member of this group. I can't see it, you know? And it started to dawn on me that it's like, that was so kind of cut off from like the broader view of the internet, you know, and a lot of people couldn't really enjoy that content. And for so long, we had just kind of like shared and talked in this echo chamber of a Facebook group, right? And so Pat and I and Kate decided, like, we need to like take this thing more like global. We need to take it more kind of like not favoring one platform, you know, but put it on something.
Even though now we're favoring Twitter all the time, it's kind of funny.
Well, for for tweets, the social media stuff, sure, we favor Twitter because it's easy to just kind of, you know, shoot off a quick tweet, you know, and communicate that way. But I mean, our site really is where everything lives, and where it's like our home base, you know. And we keep pouring more and more into the site and trying to make it better, so that there's more value there for the community and more collateral. But yeah, Pat and I don't know. It just kind of, I think Pat said this recently on some podcast that we kind of just throw stuff at the wall and see what sticks, you know, we're always kind of bouncing ideas off of each other. We're not afraid to try new things. We took Peter's brilliant writing and went ahead and did layout and made a magazine, which was really fun. It kind of fulfilled a childhood fantasy of mine. I grew up reading the official Sega Saturn magazine. The UK has like this brilliant heritage of magazines, which we kind of try to emulate in the United States, but no, like, it's not on the same level. Like, my eyes have been opened to the fact that the UK just has like this rich heritage of magazines, you know, and it's a very competitive industry. But some of the best work is done in that industry and in the UK. Yeah. I mean, look at Retro Gamer magazine and as an example, that's just one small example, but, and you got stuff like Sega Powered So Peter and I always dreamed of like making a magazine. And so we just kind of sat down and made it happen.
It is amazing. I just want to add.
Thank you.
We hope to do more, but it's not for the faint of heart. Definitely. It's like, you know, there are people that do that for a living, you know, and it's like, they'll even tell you. So to do it as just a hobby was insane, you know, but we did it. And, Shiro Show started during the pandemic. You know, I think Pat and I we had more time on our hands and everybody was hunkered down, you know? So it's like, we started streaming and doing it consistently every Friday. And before you know it, it spun into like this news show where we're telling everybody about. And I mean, I guess that just happened because, right, Pat, that just happened because there's so much news.
Yeah. The thing is that we would do podcasts and half it would be us talking about the new up and comings and stuff like that. And the thing is that it would always be like a month or month and a half since the podcast would drop afterwards. So it'd be old information, outdated. And they're like, I think the thing is that, why don't we just cut out the news and just do like a show like on Fridays, like I hang out and talk about the news and the upcomings and the things that are happening and just talk about that. So that way we can leave the podcast to be the podcast and make it evergreen and have this other show that's not evergreen that, yeah, it's more of an archive show where it's like, here's all the news. And then I don't know if you can curse bullshitting about different things like music. Like I can name sometimes where it'd be a slow news week and it would be us trying to figure out what our top five albums are or the top best grunge albums are, or I think my favorite one we ever did was the perfect albums, like the albums that were perfect and be listened to without ever skipping anything.
Yeah, like, you know, solid gold from front to back. They're rare, but they do exist. But I don't want to get off into that.
But yeah, I didn't mean to get off traffic, but like the idea is that, we just really wanted to do the show and it was a lot of fun. Like, I mean, I still can't believe it's over 3 years since we started it. It was like March of 21. We're almost up to 3 years and it's every Friday. I think we literally only missed like a single digit amount of shows, like because like of either Christmas.
Like three shows I think we've missed in 3 years of doing it. It's crazy. But I mean, Yeah, so we, out of the magazine, we spun up Editor's Corner, and that started with me and Peter just kind of doing these like one-on-one, almost like a phone conversation you would have with a friend, unscripted, just talking about like thoughts and experiences and stuff like that. And it was supposed to be this like 60-minute podcast, but it spun into a 2-hour podcast. And then, you know, Peter couldn't do it, and we've started to bring on different people on Editor's Corner. But with Editor's Corner, there's no outline. It's not rehearsed or scripted. It's just really like take a topic and chew on the fat, you know?
Yeah.
So essentially, there's the mainline cast, which is very produced and very much like evergreen content. There's Editor's Corner, and then there's Shiro Show, and then there's the magazine and the website, and Dan Thrax, who was a community member and a fan patcher who, you know, worked with the Bulk Slash team and the Stellar Assault team. He got really involved. It was funny. He was only a Saturn fan for a few years before that, but he got super involved in the group. And then before you know it, was like writing a ton of content, or at least a ton of news for the site, and then started coming on Shiro Show. And before you know it, like now Shiro Show has three hosts basically, which is great, because it's kind of what I always wanted. I had that big couch and I was like, yeah. Pat and I are sitting so far away from each other, you know, there needs to be one other host on the couch, you know. So now Dan's in the middle,
and it's a good backup in case one of us can't make it. So it's like, that, oh, Pat can't make it because I'm sick, so then we at least have two people to bounce off each other. Or, oh hey, Dave can't make it because he's not feeling well, or he's going on vacation, okay, or one of us, like it's a good backup, so that way we can have more people. And of course, the guests, of course, are always welcome on the show any day.
I don't think we've ever been great at playing the whole like YouTube algorithm game, you know? And I mean, like, I know that there are ways to do it, but none of us have really sat down and felt like doing it, you know? Instead, our strength has always been in the community, and like many hands make light work, you know? So yeah, if Pat gets sick, you know, Dan and I can pick it up, you know, or vice versa, you know? And instead of worrying about the numbers and stuff like that, we really just worry about building a solid community.
And the numbers are coming. Like, we're making like solid 60 viewers per stream, which doesn't seem like a lot in the big scheme of things. But right. I mean,
it's a slow build.
Yeah.
But there's quality, you know, instead of just quantity, there's quality. Like, I feel like our community feels like a family, you know, and there's so many talented individuals that bring so much to the table, you know, like Joe, Sega RPG fan who brought back Netplay on the Saturn, you know, real Netplay. Like, you can't scoff at it. It's not glitchy. It doesn't hang. It just works. Like it was
we're
back
doing
in the day.
Full-ass tournaments.
Yeah, we're doing full tournaments with prizes.
Speaking of YouTube, where does, because I am a big fan of his videos, where does Pandemonium come into this? How did he get involved?
Yes, because here's the thing. Basically, I do this thing where a lot of we all know like who the big YouTubers are, right? And the ones that are really loud and show up on your timeline the most. But like, I'm always really interested in seeing what new folks are doing. And YouTube doesn't make that easy to figure that out. Yeah. They're certainly not showing you. But I do this thing where I just kind of like, I have a Saturn search, saved search, you know, Saturn. And I kind of always sort it by the newest uploaded, right? And it doesn't matter like how many numbers they have or anything like that. I just want to see like who's uploading Saturn content the most recently, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of times it's Let's Plays. A lot of times it's like one dude just playing through some random game or some dude talking into a camera. A lot of stuff that's pretty typical for YouTube. But, you know, every once in a while, someone comes up in my feed and I'm just like, wow, this is special. There's something special about this person. And Nick was one of those where it was like when he uploaded his first video of Saturn content, it was like he wanted to rate or review like the entire Saturn, the entire US Saturn collection. And I was just like, okay, immediate sub, you know, that's awesome. And you could also tell there was something about his voice. I was like, wow, he probably does this for a living or something. And turns out he does. Like, he broadcast journalism is his job.
Yeah, you could hear that high quality in like his really early videos. Like, they were, you know, high quality straight off the bat, right? Yeah.
And I mean, if you wonder why, it's because he went to school for this, you know? So it's like, even when Pat and I see him you know, we see him at work, like at PRGE, filming and you know, interviewing people. I'm just like, okay, he went to school for this. Like, he is a consummate professional. Like, he knows what he's doing, you know?
Yeah, because, yeah. Like, me and Dave, like, we've done our fair work behind the camera, and we filmed a bunch of videos and stuff before, and, like, a lot of the video shots that I did, it's like, I feel like I'm fumbling around with it, and Nick is just, like, sitting there confident, and it's like, I'm trying my best to get the right shots, you know, experiment, and then Nick's just like, bam, he's straight into the ball game. He's right there, right in the corner, and it's like, I'm sitting there, like wandering around, like trying to figure out how am I going to get the shot, how am I going to focus this, and Nick doesn't even think about it. He's like,
but it's just a standard work day. It's just a standard work day for him, you know. Like, he does this stuff by memory. No, his content was great. He at the same time was a member of the Facebook groups, you know, so I could tell that his conduct was great. You know, he was easy to talk to. He was a nice guy. He was well adjusted. You know, he wasn't like, didn't have a few screws loose or anything like that, you know. So, and we were looking for new collaborators, you know, or new, you know, folks to kind of bring into the fold. And we reached out to him and he was totally down, you know. So, so he became our fifth and final, like, leadership member of Shiro.
Yeah. And he's really, like I said, and we both support each other. We technically produce his show in a way, I guess, in name. But like I said, we've been able to help him out with different things, projects, getting a hold of people, we're your translator. Because I don't want to take credit for the amazing work he's done. Like, no, I think it's amazing. Like, not at all, but I like the fact that he allows us to assist him on, is the better word I'm looking for. Like, like, I like that we can give him the help that he needs and help him make him reach his goal. If that makes sense.
Like, there was a time, I'm just saying, I remember the time where he was in the low hundreds of subscribers, right? And we said, we want to help boost that and help you grow. And we're going to do everything we can to kind of like, to bolster, you know, put you on our shoulders and bolster you up, right? But I always knew that Panda was going to blow up. Like, I always knew his channel was going to blow up.
It was
a matter of time. I was like, you're going to outgrow us even, you know? But that's fine. That's great. I want you to, you know, all the best, you know? We just wanted to support him.
In all honesty, he already has. If he really wanted to, he could just be like, okay, bye, guys.
Nah, he's always shouting you guys out in his videos, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, he's got his own Patreon at this point. But I mean, yeah, but the thing is, Nick's such a great guy, you know, and he'll always be, you know, a Shiro, like, always a Shiro.
Yeah, man.
You know?
So, were you originally just Saturn? Like, when did that choice come in? You know, guys, we need to cover Dreamcast as well.
So, the idea with it is that we were going to be exclusively Saturn, and we had a lot of people that wanted to just, and at least that wanted to just do Saturn, and we were literally just Saturn and only Saturn, because that's what we covered. And we, like, honestly, I took the mentality of that. I feel like we'd be stepping on you guys. We did Dreamcast, and it's like, these guys are encroaching on our territory again. Let's get the lead pipes and the chains.
But now they're more the better when it comes to discussing Dreamcast, in my opinion.
Yeah, but the idea was to focus on that. I think that the point where I at least actively noticed that we were switching over to Dreamcast and Mega Drive and, well, not, I mean, more Dreamcast and more broad Sega focus is when we were reached out by Sega to celebrate their 20th anniversary. I think it specifically was Europe, I think. Was it Europe for the 20th Dreamcast, right, Dave?
I believe so.
Yeah, and we did a stream for Dreamcast. It was me and Ben did a game stream for Dreamcast. Like, I think Ben did a couple other obscure games, and I switched over and did, like, Sonic Adventure and stuff like that. And I think at that point, I think is when we started to do, let's maybe do some Dreamcast stuff, because I really, like I said, I'm a massive Dreamcast fan, and I could probably go on forever about how I love the Dreamcast. But like I said, it that was just a slow transition, and then we started, hey, maybe we can add a little bit of Dreamcast here and there and start talking about that a little bit more. Maybe do some streams where I play some Phantasy Star online or something like that online, like play it with the broadband modem and stuff. And at least that's how I feel. How do you feel about it, Dave? Do you feel that that's sort of the same evolution, or did you feel there was a more different change for that?
Well, there were definitely conversations at the beginning of what we wanted to be, even, you know, and like it, did we feel like we were nailing ourselves down to something that was doomed to have kind of like a finite end by being Saturn, you know? And I'd have conversations with other friends who do YouTube professionally, but like for completely different interests, completely different fields. And they would say, no, I think it's a great thing that you have the Saturn niche, you know, because you don't have a whole lot of competition, you know, and there's always going to be new things that you can explore with it. But at the same time, yeah, Pat and I are like, I absolutely love the Dreamcast. One of my favorite consoles of all time. It's an incredible console, and there are so many great games on it that we could go on and on. But again, like you guys were doing it, it definitely didn't feel like it was a hole that we really needed to fill. So every once in a while, something will happen, and it'll be kind of parallel to what we normally cover. And we'll feel like covering it, you know, because there's enough of a relation. It might be somebody in our community, for example, like Derek Pasquarello, A-Team, longtime Shiro community. Well, he's again, like we remember when he wasn't even doing any of this stuff. You know, he was just a dude. He was a dude in our Discord chat, and we would talk about New York. We'd talk about Saturn. He's a huge Saturn fan, by the way. Loves yeah. Saturn too. And actually, Derek's got excellent taste. He's a fan of several different game consoles, to be completely honest. And he's a huge hardware nerd. Like he all of his yeah. consoles are like, you know, recapped and modded and stuff like that. So, but I mean, great guy. And so whenever he does something with the Dreamcast, because that's kind of his wheelhouse, we definitely feel like supporting that and, you know, helping to boost that signal.
Shout him out. Yeah,
exactly. So, I mean, we would love to be able to like, you know, cover the Dreamcast as well, but with as limited time as we have and stuff like that, it's just nice to be able to have that focus of just the Saturn.
Mm-hmm. Not to mention there's so many like, you know, groups that are like Dave was saying, it's like, there's so many, like the focus helps us. It helps us like, get that audience, because there's so many retro game beard bros where it's like mm-hmm. they talk about a bunch of retro games and it's like it mm-hmm. just comes off yeah. as, to me it's like, I don't mean to throw them under the bus, their content I respect that, and of course I'm not attacking them for that, but to me like content like that is, it doesn't excite me as much as it used to be, where it's like right. top 10 hidden gems, it's like
I never wanted Pat and I to be like the dollar store version of that, you know, like I didn't want us to exactly. be like the discount, you know, game chasers or whatever. So I wanted, you know, it felt good to have that niche, you know, and it was something that we were both passionate about. I would love to cover, you know, like Genesis, Mega Drive stuff too. But let's be honest, like there are probably more sites dedicated to Genesis and Mega Drive yeah. than any of the other Sega stuff. So it's well covered. It's a well treaded path, you know? So I just feel like, yeah, for SEO and like search and stuff like that. And when people search Saturn, there's a better chance they're going to find us if we just kind of stick to that. But
clearly SG-1000 needs to.
Right. Well, Jeremy Parrish just released a really good book about it, by the way.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. From what I don't own it, but Dan picked it up and he said it was great. So it's a tome. Folks should check it out.
That's amazing. I love that someone produced such a thing. Like, mm-hmm. You know, even if it, you know, I guess is quite niche, like I just love it. You know, the niche the better for me sometimes.
I also was reminded or remembered as you were all talking about that there is actually an SG-1000 junkyard.
It was Scott from Australia who did that. There was all kinds of different spin-offs. Yeah. I think the Saturn junkyard and the Dreamcast junkyard were like the main ones. Oh, it was an April Fool's Day joke. I thought it was. Yeah, they made like just for a minute, they were like, we're gonna do the SG-1000. But then I think it actually got a few articles. Like you can still find it online.
No, he kept updating it through for a couple of years, it looks like.
Fly high,
I guess I'd be remiss if we didn't let you riff about Dreamcast stuff for a little bit. Although that, you know, as you mentioned, Pat, you could talk about it pretty much forever, as the Junkyard is designed to do.
Pat is going to be buried with his Dreamcast, apparently. he's gone on record saying that.
this actually is not a joke. I've actually informed my family that if I do pass away, that I will be buried with my Dreamcast. That honestly is not. I actually don't know which one I want to be buried with.
It's small enough. You shouldn't have a problem fitting it in the coffin.
May I do? I don't know if I want to do the Soccer Wars one, or I want to do my one I played on that I poured blood, sweat, and tears into.
Yeah, maybe that's not the Soccer Wars. Some like a collector will like dig it up.
Yeah,
yeah. It can't be too valuable.
Yeah, the Grave Robbers. It's like they pull out of my arms break off, and it's like I just haunt them forever.
All right, so. Assuming there is room in the coffin, what three games are you burying yourself with, Pat?
damn, that one's a hard one. Definitely, if I had to pick one, probably definitely Ikaruga, because I think it's probably my favorite shmup. I could pretty much play off and on, very simple to play, but hard to master. Sonic Adventure 1, since I think it's probably the best Sonic Adventure game, or yet the best Sonic game, period. I know that's a hot take, but
yeah.
I just think the soundtrack is just so... like it's honestly, objectively, the best one, in my opinion. I guess that's not really an objective thing, but...
I agree with you, Patrick, but I know that's a bit of a game where it gets a lot of dislikes online, doesn't it? But there's a hard... the hardcore, no.
Yeah, exactly. It's a really great game. I love Sonic Adventure 1. And maybe for the last one, that one's a hard one. Maybe Toy Commander if I had to pick another one, just because I put so many hours into Toy Commander.
Good pick, yeah.
Love Toy Commander, one of my favorites. I imagine Dave's going to be like, oh, Patrick, what about this game that's your favorite? Oh, JoJo and JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, one of my favorite fighting games of all time. That one for sure. I even wrote it up on the Junkyard.
Yeah, on our top 200. Yeah, that was great.
That or Super Magnetic Neo, which is the best version of Crash Bandicoot.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to say, it's the best Crash Bandicoot game.
I mean, and you're leaving out so many great... What about Power Stone, Pat? What about Marvel versus Capcom? What about, you know...
Listen, like, I'm gonna put all 70 of my Dreamcast games in the coffer with me, so...
Yeah, good idea.
I'll pick all of those ones, but I just have so many. I just, like, even in the Soccer Wars ones, I forgot... Mm-hmm. Oh, I actually have my craziest Dreamcast collection I have is I have an autographed thing of a... of what's her name, the voice actor for the main character in Soccer Wars 3, BP Husker found it at a game store. And I forgot who, Erica Fontaine's voice actor signed Soccer Wars 3, and I have a copy on my shelf. It's pretty amazing.
Nice.
But yeah, that's going to get better than me. But what about you, Dave? What's your top 3 or 5 or 20?
I mean, that is such a cruel... an unusual punishment to make me limit to just 3. I mean, so like, I don't even, okay. Yeah, I mean, if you could give me 5.
Yeah, I copied KC off the Sega Lounge, so blame him.
Well, keep in mind, you're only going to be buried with these. You're not going to be able to play them. You'll be dead.
I'm going to be buried with them.
We don't have to make it as morbid as Patrick's.
Oh, well, then it has to be like symbolic or something like that. But no, so okay, so almost every game on the Dreamcast is a banger, in my opinion. There are some turds, but I mean the bangers far outweigh the turds. This console just has such a great library. So my favorite game, the one that I go on record saying, okay, it's my favorite Dreamcast game of all time, is Phantasy Star Online. Means a lot to me.
Yeah.
It was a formative game for me, you know, playing online with people across the world. And
is it too late to change my options? I forgot about that too.
On dial-up, 56K dial-up with a keyboard. I had my little brother piloting the keyboard and just, you know, doing the chat while I play the game. It was lots of fun. That's going to be number one. Number two, I'll go with Rez. Okay, because like the whole synesthesia thing, the whole like sound and like that game just, and I mean, there's so many great games like that, but I'm gonna go with Rez, okay, for number two.
How did you play that like back when it came out? Did you maybe import it? Because obviously it wasn't in the States, was it?
It never hit the States, but it was definitely one of the ones that I got in the early 2000s, like when the Dreamcast had already, it was already gone, you know, but it was like 2004 or 2005 or like when I first played Rez, mm-hmm. and it just hit me like, this game is special. I want to say Shenmue, but I don't think I just feel like that's such a typical answer. I'll go with something like Cannon Spike. How about that? I'll say Cannon
Spike.
That
was a good one.
Yeah. Oh, but I mean, like, oh, I forgot to say Machin X. Like, I like Machin X too.
We'll give you five, Dave. There you go. You can have
okay,
five.
So if I, so then I would go Machin X, and then I would say D2, because I have to put a Kenji Eno game in there.
You've got to go Eno. You got to go
Eno. That is
like
top tier taste, D2. I like the fact, actually, I don't know if Derek from Stop Skeletons from Fighting would agree with this, because I know he wasn't quite keen on D2, but... I do feel like that game has had a real reassessment. I know we have that kind of thing with movies, you know, they, maybe people don't really like them when they first come out, but and then they kind of get more love over time. I think D2 is definitely trending in that direction. Like there's so, so many times I hear people say they love that game and kind of appreciate, especially with Kenji Eno passing, you know, they've kind of gone back and thought, you know, this was his final huge game that he brought us.
Yeah. I just love those games that are like really inspired by film, you know? And so you've got like Deep Fear, which is really inspired by The Abyss, you know, like the underwater research station and everything like that, you know? Yeah. And then like, you know, all this weird stuff going on. And then you've got like Enemy Zero, which was really inspired by Aliens, the movie Aliens, you know, with the ding, ding, ding. It's getting closer, you know? And then you've got like D2, which is super inspired by The Thing, you know, John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah.
You're in this Antarctic they're in Northern Canada, but basically the snowy
close
environment
enough.
And you're hunting and you're going to these little, like you have these little respite, like, outpost stations that you can kind of relax in and explore stuff, but then you're like shooting aliens out in the snow. It's there's just something about it that is incredible. There are so many others that are kind of like that are just heavily inspired. But yeah, I love D2. I love Kenji Eno for sure.
Amazing. Yeah. Did you watch the documentary they put out recently?
Oh, within a half hour of it going live. yeah. I that's what I watched that night with popcorn and everything. It was great.
Yeah. It was so good.
Yeah.
I love the story in that where he was talking about how he was driving.
Yes. It was Pacific Highway. It was right along the Pacific Highway.
Yeah.
Right up where my family has like a beach house that we share up in it was near San Luis Obispo. But yeah, I know exactly where what he's talking about. Like La Conchita is like this tiny little town right there on the Pacific Highway. And there was a mudslide and it like the whole town kind of like slid into the road and was blocked things off, you know?
Who was he with in the car?
Oh, Tetsuya Mitsuguchi.
That's it. Yeah.
Mitsuguchi. Yeah.
And he was like, the story's like he was, they were driving and Tetsuya Mitsuguchi was driving and Kenjino's in the passenger seat like, oh, hey, Mr. Sega Rally, you know, like but kind of just joking around with him. I love that story so much.
Right. Yeah. No, that was great.
Yeah. I also forgot my Naomi game. Technically, it's not, but I think Lewis knows my favorite Naomi game, though. It's gonna be Azumanga Daioh Puzzle Bobble.
Yes, top tier taste as well. You know, from the D2 to the Azumanga Daioh pick, there, amazing. I didn't know that was on Naomi. You know, I need to play it one day.
It's a lot of fun. Like I said, if you like Puzzle Bobble and you like Azumanga Daioh, which is objectively the best slice of life anime, technically speaking, or best school. Ice-oriented anime, highly recommend it.
I am really happy that today was the day we mentioned Azumanga on the Dream Pod.
Hell yeah. Like I said, as much as I can get that anime in, everyone needs to watch it.
Yeah.
But I mean, I didn't even get to mention, for example, Tokyo Street, exactly, the Genki games.
Or Highway Challenge, if you're... in PAL territories.
Tokyo Extreme Racer 1 and 2, those were huge games for my brother-in-law, and like he was really into cartooning and stuff like that, and that's kind of like were some of the first games that kind of got me interested in cartooning and stuff like that and street racing, and such good games to not mention them is I feel a crime, you know. The crazy thing with the Dreamcast is you also have stuff like Propeller Arena, which is like an incredibly great game that like wasn't released back in the day, but then, you know, we got it, you know. And I mean, that game is, that's so good. It's classic Sega arcade stuff, you know. It's funny, it's mostly the original games on the Dreamcast that I love the most. The ones that were basically like successors to the versions on the Saturn, like take Daytona or Sega Rally 2, you know, I didn't enjoy that much. Even Virtua Fighter 3 TB, I'm not like the biggest fan of those, because I felt that they were much stronger on the Saturn. But it's all the games that the Dreamcast did new, you know, like Samba de Amigo and Space Channel 5 and, you know, all that cool stuff that they did. Even Resident Evil Code Veronica, which, yes, it made it to other consoles, but I played it for the first time on the Dreamcast.
It is interesting that Sega, you know, were like, we're going to do something different. And you know, the Sega Saturn sequels on the Dreamcast are pretty slim. I mean, Fighting Vipers 2, Sega Rally 2. Like, I think you named most of like the notable ones.
I mean, D2. Oh, there you go. D2 is the one. That's the only one that I think is like super strong. Oh, yeah. House of the Dead 2, of course. Better, arguably better than House of the Dead on the Saturn.
Honestly, I'd argue House of the Dead 2 is like objectively the best game in the series, in my opinion.
Yeah. Definitely, exactly. Yeah. But you had original stuff like so the Dreamcast was basically a Naomi, right? Mm-hmm. So they brought home a lot of the stuff that was in the arcade. And one of the things that was, I think if you could say anything about the Dreamcast that rings true, is that for the first time, and I mean like for the first time as a gamer, you really didn't feel like you were missing the arcade.
No.
You know, when you had a Dreamcast in your home, you, for the first time, you felt like you had parity in the home, because you'd go to the arcade and you'd see the games like Sega Bass Fishing, or you'd see, you know, and you'd come home and you'd play it on your Dreamcast and you're like, yeah, I don't feel like I'm missing out. Like the graphics are the same.
Yeah.
I know that Naomi has some bells and whistles.
Yeah, especially considering like the consoles that came right before, like, you know, Nintendo 64, that leap in graphics was astounding. I remember seeing Power Stone for the first time and thinking, wow, this game looks amazing, you know, so colorful.
And a lot of the games have held up even to this day, you know, if they're, especially if they're stylized, you know, but, and then you're playing this Dreamcast on VGA or whatever, you know, it looks so crisp. Marvel versus Capcom 2 plays just as good today as it did back then. Like it's a pick up and play. Just have a blast, you know, Outrigger. Games like Outrigger, you know, like I love Outrigger. I wish I could put that on my top five, but there's just not enough space, you know. Ikaruga is like an insane, like, treasure, you know. It's an insane follow-up to, you know, Radiant Silvergun. And I would argue it does a lot of things better than Radiant Silvergun, but... You know, Radiant Silvergun has more in terms of like story and plot and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it says a lot when a lot of games are just straight ported. Like, you know, Radergy, I know, got a new HD release. A few other ones did. And it's just like, even Rainbow Cotton's getting a release and with minimal changes to that. So that's going to be awesome. Yeah. I'm excited to see, like, and like I said, that's what I like about the 6th gen. A lot of them are just almost straight ports, like Wind Waker and stuff like that. It's just like just a little bit of fancy HD and it's good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The arcade through line for both consoles is, you know, incredibly strong for good reason.
I mean, the same can be said for Mega Drive too.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it was kind of chasing it. Yeah, it was kind of chasing it, and then of course Saturn got closer, and in some ways, I mean, I think I enjoy playing Sega Rally more on Saturn than arcade version. And then you know, Dreamcast, maybe they grew more in parity or pretty much one-to-one, but, you know, integral to those experiences. And something I miss today, and maybe that's what's drawn me to VR a little bit, is just the usage of the physical space and other ways to interact with those games that kind of connect you more intuitively via their peripherals, you know, really made those experiences what they are, and unique to the arcades, because it was, you know, such a novel concept to have, you know, whether it was a firefighter hose or, you know, even just a nice, huge hydraulic racing cab or fishing controller, you know. I do think another area where we saw those strides with the Saturn and Dreamcast both were you know, Sega's attempts to replicate that through its peripheral output on the on those consoles, including some really kind of batshit ones. So I guess if we were
like the fishing
yeah,
controller.
Like if we're going to add one more thing to the Order of Maracas or whatever it is, if we're going to add a peripheral to your tomb that you would be buried with for either console, what do you think that would be?
Well, I was going to say for the Dreamcast, it would have to be the fight stick because you can't play fighting games with that controller.
Yeah. You know?
I feel like it's almost like an absolute, it's necessary. It's like a required, you know, a peripheral for the Dreamcast. You have to have a good fight stick, you know.
Did you bury yourself with any fighting games?
I didn't. I don't think I did. I didn't. But then again, you said I'm not going to be playing them. So it's really more representative.
That's true. You're ghost. Yeah. You're ghost, mate.
You never know. We don't know what happens down there.
Yeah, Pat's Mr. Bones, you know.
Oh, no, I'm like Mr. Bones, except I'm going to be playing good games instead of fucking Mr. Bones the rest of my life.
You know, for the Saturn, I think I will go with the Netlink because, again, Sega as a company and the CEO, the dude who gave all his money to save Sega. Yeah, so like his whole goal with CSK and everything like that from the very get-go was like communications, right? And they tried with the Mega Modem, but that was kind of a dud. They tried again with the X-Band and Netlink, you know, and to some success, but just, you know, it hit when the console wasn't very strong. And then, of course, they finally hit it out of the park with the Dreamcast. They finally got, but they had been trying for ages, you know? And to get this good, it takes ages, right? You know, little nod to that. No, they finally got it with including the 56K modem with the Dreamcast and kicked off, you know, real, you know, console online gaming. And then, you know, the others would follow suit, you know, like PlayStation and Xbox would follow suit later. But Dreamcast really made that a reality because they pushed for it for so long. But I would go Netlink with the Saturn because I love that it's, you know, the Saturn was just so ahead of its time. PlayStation didn't have anything like that. You know, Nintendo 64 didn't have anything like that. So yeah, I'm going to go Netlink.
For me, for the Saturn, specifically the Virtual One, sorry, the Twin Sticks. So that way I can cheat and get the adapter and play the Twin Sticks on both the Dreamcast and the Saturn. So I can have two on Dreamcast.
That would be two peripherals. You get one.
Oh, just the one. All right. Well, for the Saturn, the Virtuon one, so I can play Virtuon, smoke people beyond the grave, and then for nice. The Dreamcast, probably the broadband adapter, so I can connect online and play Phantasy Star Online and go through that. Because I just think the broadband adapter is so cool. It's just so neat.
And you could really mess with the living by sending them emails and stuff.
Yeah.
I control them. I can drop a thousand. Was it the currency, just drop it all over the map and just troll them all the time. So it works. So, but yeah, I really enjoy the broadband adapter. I've probably had the most fun I've ever had with a Dreamcast peripheral any time with the Dreamcast broadband modem. It's worth it. It's a bit expensive, but honestly, I think it's worth it just so you can easily connect online. You don't have to finick with a DreamPi or anything like that. It's just like, just plug and play. Like I literally just plugged it straight into my wall. My Netlink switch, and I was able to connect online. No questions asked.
Nice.
I just feel like Dreamcast, like for the most part, there are exceptions, you know? Like, for example, Dead or Alive 2, I think, is pretty strong. It's a pretty strong, like, follow-up. Cyber Troopers, Virtualon, Oratorio Tangram, or whatever
Ontario,
you call
Canada,
it.
Like, I think is...
It just wasn't... It didn't hit for me as well as, like, the first game. On Saturn. So yeah, for the most part, I feel like the games that I remember and love the most about Dreamcast are the ones where they kind of just went in a new direction. You know, Crazy Taxi, Jet Set Radio, and then you had your weird stuff like Cool Cool Tune and Cosmic Smash.
C-Man,
sure. Choo Choo Rocket is another one that's like, I love that game.
DD Planet's really sick too.
DD Planet, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Seaman was an experience for sure. I almost don't feel like it's a game, but it definitely was an interesting experience, you know, and very, very much characteristic of the Dreamcast, you know, just the fact that they had that kind of freedom to try anything, you know.
Yeah,
that doesn't happen very much anymore, unless it's in the indie scene, you know. But that doesn't happen on like where they're given such a huge blank check, you know. make whatever you want, you know, and get Leonard Nimoy to to voice it, you know.
I mean, it was such a fascinating period at a time where, you know, I think Sega was against, you know, their back was against the wall in many ways. They had been hemorrhaging money for a long time.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, I think they felt at their, at that point, they needed a compelling point of differentiation in order to, you know, as one of the requisite elements to survival. And so that kind of put them in a place to take risks they otherwise probably wouldn't have, and that other companies, certainly more fiscally responsible ones, would not have taken. And that's why you just don't see that kind of gusto every now. So, you know, you haven't really seen that since putting, you know, a company placing so much of its fortunes and just giving such freedom to its developers to really be the face of the console in that way, which is such a fascinating and endearing thing that I just don't think we'll ever see again. And, you know, it was such a, just a, an amazing time that I think continues, is one of the main reasons that continues to endear us to the Dreamcast.
I feel like for so long, the Dreamcast enjoyed like indie games, you know, like the Dreamcast was really easy to develop for. And so it was always kind of ironic to me that while Saturn came first, you know, it didn't really have much of an indie or homebrew scene for the longest time.
Because of the copy protection, right?
The copy protection, the difficulty of, you know, just programming.
There just wasn't a lot of good engine options.
You either had to know assembly or you had to figure out how to use those Sega graphics libraries. And they're just, I don't know, like, I think it's true that people do kind of tend to take the path of least resistance. And there's a hell of a lot less resistance on the Dreamcast, you know? They made it to be a console that was easy to develop for, and it is, you know? So I think we just saw a lot of, arguably, the first ones were shmups, you know? There were a lot of 2D shmups of varying degrees of quality on the Dreamcast. But for the most part, you could still argue that, you know, Dreamcast was, you know, getting new stuff every year. And so, yeah, like it was crazy to me that like the Saturn had quite a bit of catching up to do in that regard.
Yeah. And because like, I mean, even now I think the Dreamcast, you're able to sell these games. Like, I mean, I still buy new Dreamcast games like Bang Bang Busters, ARMS 7, stuff like that. There's so many new ones you could buy that are like, licensed games. Well, I wouldn't say licensed by Sega, but it's like games you could actually buy and play on there and like legally buy versus that. And like, I think Saturn really only has one, which is the, which is the one by Sansugolo, the
Neuromage Studios, the Red
Moon? Red Days,
Red Moon Lost Days.
Red Moon Lost Days is really the only one you could right now buy for the Saturn legally and play it. And even then you need a, you need a way to play backup games on it versus the Dreamcast where it's like you just throw it on any.
We're at the beginning. We're at the beginning here of what I think will be.
Yeah, we're still trying to catch up to y'all.
Well, in many ways, I would say that, I mean, just given the existence of all of the side projects you have, which focus on trying to keep up with the goings on in the community, I'd say in many ways, even if the retail box game, you know, aspect isn't one of them. I mean, certainly the fan patches and translations and hacks and, you know, homebrew games. I mean, you still have that in spades, right?
Yes.
And
so that is something that the Saturn has in spades, is this huge Japanese library that was kind of locked off to the West due to the language barrier, which in some cases with some games is a pretty steep language barrier, you know? And so folks have like tried over the years to play those games, you know, to varying degree with a guide or, you know, just kind of playing their way blind through it, you know. But I mean, having a lot of these games translated opens them up to English audiences, and it is kind of like getting new games, you know, to a lot of us, you know, especially when you get the story with it, you know.
I think Soccer Wars is a big example of that.
Huge example. Yeah, huge example. Huge game in Japan too, like a system seller. Yeah. Top tier, you know, and then over here, just relatively unknown unless you're a huge weeaboo. And then, you know, now, but we're getting it. And it's actually a phenomenal game. Multi-genre game that has just a ton of stuff to enjoy in it. So
Fire Emblem before it became Fire Emblem, really, like the Awakening.
Mouse support. It's got mouse support. It's got, you know, so many good things about, and that's just one small example. Yeah. So Pat, that is the great thing about Saturn. Fans are eating good today because we're getting so many new translations.
We just got one yesterday too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kingdom
Grand Prix. That one existed all along and we just didn't, you know, so I mean, yeah, that's the thing. The fans are finding different ways. Either they're patching them themselves and doing the translation, or like Bo Bales reverse engineering the game and figuring out that there's, you know, an existing translation already locked in there, you know, or finding out that Clockwork Knight 2 has Clockwork Knight 1 in it, making it accessible, you know, it's crazy.
You've got a lot of like homebrew stuff as well. Like I think I saw it recently, Cold Case.
Yeah.
It looks just wow. Like that, you know, that looks like a game that could have come out on the system back in the day. You know, that is really impressive work, and you know, I love to see more projects like that. But I believe, I suppose, going back to Shiro here, you guys do like a contest, don't you? Like related to homebrew and stuff.
Well, we don't. Oh, we don't. Okay. It's Sega Extreme. So Emerald Nova, who's kind of, he's one of our oldest patron supporters. He organizes the contest, and he's really been the driving force, I guess. But and then Sega Extreme hosts it. And of course, Sega Extreme has been huge for patches and homebrew and all that stuff. You know, Sega Extreme is a great resource to the community. But yeah, so they host it. We just love shouting out about it, basically. We just love being a platform that folks can talk about it on, you know, because that's the thing, is a lot of these creators, a lot of these small developers, they're working so hard, but they don't have a voice, you know, they don't have like a huge voice outside of like a small forum, you know? So we'll take that, turn it into an article and boost, you know, boost their signal, you know, so that folks can see that, wow, there's like Seven Shades, this guy who just decided to create this cute little cat platformer on the Saturn. And I think it's adorable. And it also controls phenomenally well. So much more so than they were able to achieve back in the day with a lot of those 3D platformers. So, you know, we're trying to give a voice to folks and give them a platform to get their stuff out there. That's probably where you got the idea that we were hosting the contest.
I think so. Yeah.
Well, yeah, just cause we care about it so much, you know?
Yeah, I mean, every year I do a stream of it where I stream for like maybe 7+ hours playing all the fan translations in a row, or all the fan translation, all the homebrews in a row, and interview the developers. And I think it's just a lot of fun to do that. I think it's a lot of fun to showcase these games and have people be like, oh man, I want to try that, or that looks kind of fun, you know, and show that, hey, these little games are just a ton of fun, and I really enjoy them. And a lot of people, some of them are games that people are working on and keep adding more and more to. Some of them are just like short little demos of little games here and there, little short games, which I think is a lot of fun. There's benefits for both of those. I just think it's amazing showcasing all these people's skills and all these people's ability, and be able to talk with them about that and discuss it, and sort of showing people the Saturn has a future. This is the Saturn's future. Not to mention, we even bring up the fan translations and all the work that they work on and how much they submit. I mean, hell, Danthrax himself and his group are submitting the one for the was Stellar Assault SS, which is an amazing fan dub of that. And honestly, they really revolutionized that to where I don't think there really is a fan dub of any games, I know, and they're just put up two of them with Bulk Slash and Stellar Assault back to back.
That's such a unique thing that they pulled off there. Like, you know, like you say, I don't think I'd ever seen that before. And you know, I think you know the fact that they thought of you know, the game's playability, you know, rather trying to play that game while reading subtitles at the same time. Yeah, it was good job to go for the dub.
Yeah, you know what? I think maybe the thing that kind of helped kick off the indie scene for the Dreamcast was that Mill CD exploit and the Utopia boot disc. You know, the fact that you had those things early on really helped a lot. Yeah. And I guess you could say with the advent of things like the Pseudo Saturn cartridge, back in the day, that kind of really made the Saturn more accessible to a lot of folks. And then beyond that, just the bevy of ODE options that we've had has really, like, you know, when stuff like that becomes available, then you just see so many more people piling on. There's so many people entering the scene, you know, because now there are means to develop a title and then debug it quickly, you know, because that's what it all comes down to is like, with the Mill CD exploit. Well, I'm just trying to think, like, as a developer, I'm not a developer, but as you know, thinking as what it must be like for a developer, they're wanting to basically be able to debug their code easily. And you can't really do that if you're having to burn CDs all the time. You know, so that limits folks' ability to, they would have had to do it in emulation or something like that. And there are still folks out there that are like pretty much developing and testing in emulators, which is, you know, that has its issues because then you try to play it on real hardware and you get varying results.
Yeah. It was fun years ago when it was just like, oh, most of the people are using emulators, but now with ODEs, it's like a lot of people are shifting more towards playing on actual hardware. So, you know, yes, a lot of people need to focus on this hardware testing because when the rubber hits the road, it's like, oh, well, it's not working. You have a bunch of unhappy people. It's like, oh, this isn't working for me. It's like, oh, I'm only emulation. You guys are using this. It's like, yeah.
Right. So you could argue that that has played a huge role in the Saturn homebrew and indie scene, is the availability of different boot methods, you know, and just it's making it easier and easier. So I really think that it's just the beginning, even though we've been hearing about this and talking about this for years, it's still like early days in terms of like what we can expect to see out of the Saturn. And you can be sure that Nick is going to, you know, Panda is going to be doing a video about all the new homebrew that came out this year, and it'll be great. So
I think there's some real passion there, because it's like, you know, there's more hurdles for the Saturn than there is the Dreamcast. In that True. Sense. And so yeah, like for people to really, you know, like you say about the developing sort of, you know, compared to the Dreamcast, and then the fact that, you know, the people that are going to be playing those games need to have some kind of mod or way to play them. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that these guys are like, nah, I'm sticking with the Saturn. This is what I want to develop for. Like just, mm-hmm. yeah, so much passion in that. I love it.
It's really impressive when you see them get something running. You know, I think with the Dreamcast, where that's headed and where it needs to go is now they've, you know, there are a few folks that have broken that 3D barrier, you know, and actually started to release 3D games, which Dreamcast is very much a 3D console, you know. So it's like for years I would be like, well, shmups are great, but I really want to see folks start, you know, developing Dreamcast games, you know, that like take advantage of its really powerful 3D. And they've started, and that's good. And I also want to see a lot more storytelling, you know, the homebrew scene, you know, you typically get folks just trying to get something up and running. You know, that's usually the story is, oh, the goal is just to get something up and running and then go from there. But of course, the way games were made is, you know, people would have storyboards and they'd sit in rooms and talk about like, what kind of story do they want to tell? What do they want this game to convey to the player, you know? And a lot of bedroom coders don't really think that way. I'm hoping, though, that that's a step that folks are willing to take, you know, that they're willing to think more about like storytelling and trying to craft a game that's more than just a simple tech demo, you know, that's an experience. Because I definitely think that they can, you know, it's just and, you know, they used to do that kind of stuff on the Amiga, too. You know, individual game developers used to do it. It's just it requires a lot more on the Dreamcast in terms of you have to have such a wide tool set, ability to do models and you know, textures and lighting and scripting and storytelling, all that stuff. That's like, it takes a team, you know, more than just a person. So I don't know, maybe the future of this is really seeing, you know, communities of people getting together to create games mm-hmm. together, you know, mm-hmm. but you see stuff like Driving Strikers, you know, it's definitely going in the right direction. You know, it's headed in the right direction.
Yeah. And especially with, you know, being an online indie game as well. I mean, that's a whole new world. Yeah.
Online indie game, 3D music. But yeah, so like I'm hoping to see the same thing with Saturn. It's a matter of time. We had Fran Matsuzaka, who did Bridget Bishop, the story about the witch, you know, it was kind of like a Alone in the Dark clone. And that's kind of cute. Like, I love seeing that where folks are willing to, even if it's a short story, you know, even if it's just like an hour playthrough, that it's got like a start, a middle, and an end, you know, and it tells some kind of a story that transcends like your typical homebrew, you know, and I'm hoping to see more of that.
Yeah. And I think you alluded to this, and this is probably, I mean, what I would love to see, you know, and I think the end is probably the goal for all of us collectively. And that is, just the will and the awareness yeah. and the interest side of it, the public opinion side, so to speak. And, yeah. You know, I think we focused rightly so on, you know, addressing so many of the technical barriers that have faced, or that both consoles have faced, to getting, you know, that scene up and running. And you know, where the potential is growing awareness and interest in being part of that community among people who otherwise wouldn't who bring those skill sets as writers, as directors, as people who can come up with very unique ideas to yes. build these games around, where they're transcending genres, just like Sega's dev teams did in their heyday, right? And so I think mm-hmm. that requires expanding the pool of talent and of passions and interests into the community to make to really make those strides to that next yeah. level. And so I guess, given that, and then of course just, you know, having people who are interested in playing those games and getting into both the mm-hmm. Saturn and Dreamcast scene. So I think as we wrap this up, I might close with kind of this final question. And that is, what is your pitch to new people who may be considering getting into these communities?
We're talking about the Saturn or the Dreamcast?
I would say at this point, I see them part and parcel with each other, in that they're kind of working towards some of the same ends. And as you mentioned earlier, you have so many people who kind of overlap in their output and contributions yeah. to both communities. So I mm-hmm. really would see that dynamic continuing in a way that doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. delineate one from the other all the time. So yeah, probably both.
Well, to me, I think if people really want to get into the, if really want a community where they could enjoy retro games, they could play a lot of fun, really niche games, and really want a community that not only is talking about the old stuff, but also developing new stuff and being able to play online, especially in a year that's a century that's very online orientated in the gaming sphere, that I think getting into Sega, Saturn, and Dreamcast is probably some of their best options in terms of retro gaming. Well, I can't say anything bad about, like, you know, some of the other consoles like Nintendo, NES, Super Nintendo. I don't think there's really any communities like this that really push the boundaries that the Sega consoles, the Saturn and Dreamcast, are right now, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think if you really want to have an have a lot of people to play with, have an audience, have a community that plays online games with, especially now when it's at its height, you probably want to take advantage of that now rather than later, when maybe there isn't any more in the future. You know, the future, we don't know what it holds. Maybe there might be a bustling online Saturn and Dreamcast community, but for all we know, it might die off and there might not be anybody around. It's a bunch of dead servers. So, I mean, if you really want to enjoy it now, now's the time. It's the height of playing online and enjoying these new fan translations.
Well, you know, recently we were at PRGE and we were working a booth, you know, this year. We had our Shiro Saturn booth, and folks would walk by and they kind of are just rubbernecking, you know, looking to see what you're doing, you know. And some folks, at least one guy I remember realized that it was Saturn related, and he was like, oh, Saturn, that's too expensive for me, right? And he walked on, and I was just like, oh, no. we're sitting here playing an ODE that's packed to the gills with illegally downloaded ROMs. Like, it's not too expensive for you, let me tell you.
You should have chased after him.
I know, right?
Well, to be fair though, he could all be one of those game collectors where it's like, oh, I just collect hard games. I don't like emulation.
It kind of made me shake my head though, because like, I feel like people are missing, if that's their mentality, they are missing out on so many great games. And so my pitch to the PlayStation gamer, you know, or the Nintendo 64 gamer out there, would be, you know, these are great consoles that you're a fan of. You know, they have their own games. You follow them because they were the loudest. They made the most noise. But there's this entire world that you're missing out on if you do not, you know, at least give Sega a chance, you know, because you've got some of the best arcade conversions. You've got great storytelling games. You've got great shooters. You've got puzzle games. You've got a bunch of other stuff. And it's not, you know, I'm sorry to the Jaguar. This is not a Jaguar or a CDI. You know, the Saturn and the Dreamcast are absolutely excellent consoles with huge libraries of great games. Of course, there's always going to be some, you know, garbage in there, but you focus on the good stuff, it's a lot of games that folks are missing out on if they completely ignore Sega. And then, you know, so I really want people out there who haven't, you know, tried to, you know, pick up a console and pick up an ODE or pick up some kind of boot method and dip your toe into the game library and see what you're missing. Because I think that these consoles kind of sell themselves.
Or let's pick up an emulator. That's the easiest way to do it.
Yeah, pick up an emulator. That's true. Yeah, you know, Saturn is not difficult to emulate anymore. Popular myth, but myth busted. It's long since been, you know, fairly relatively easy to emulate and even upscale. I mean, if go check out Nuno's stuff on the Junkyard, he'll tell you all about, you know, how you can play Saturn games in 4K, you know. But I mean, I think also, like Pat was saying, you know, like the community aspect, if you're looking to get into a community, I mean, Sega, one of Sega's strengths has always been its community, its fans. Like, what a diehard fandom, you know, the fans have really pushed for so much, you know, and it's been a company that hasn't really, you know, been so close to the chest. Like it's unlike Nintendo, where they're so protective of their IPs and they're so, you know, cease and desist about everything that fans do. You know, Sega has been more open to efforts that the fans have made, or at least, you know, not completely shutting everything down. Yeah. You know, I know that's not always the case, but, you know, I think that if we want to see more great Sega stuff, we have to send a loud and clear message, you know, that we're still interested, that we still love these franchises, and that we're still willing to put our time, love, and attention and engagement into these consoles, you know. So yeah, I don't know what the future holds for younger generations, because I know that I've heard some negative comments recently from younger folks who, you know, kind of have glancing encounters with the console and then just call it crap, you know, because they, for one reason or another, it didn't gel with them. But I mean, like, I feel like the Dreamcast, you fire it up and play almost any game, and it's an amazing console. So I don't know if that just means I'm really old and I have this old mentality, or if it really is, because I think that some things are just classic, you know, some bands are just classic. It doesn't matter how old it is. Younger generations are going to continue to go back and discover them, you know, and enjoy them. And I think that Sega consoles are like that, you know, they're just classic.
Yeah, I mean, Sega itself, you know, like, you know, I know lots of kids love like Sonic and stuff, but like, I could just imagine some kid who's like, you know, like I say, into Sonic or other stuff that Sega publish, and then go, what, they made game consoles? Like, that'd be, that's kind of an interesting thought that could happen.
Yeah. What you get with a Sega console though is personality. I know that this is kind of maybe cliche or trite to say. That isn't to say that, I mean, you get some personality with Nintendo, not as much so with PlayStation and Xbox. You know, the more you get, I don't know. With Sega consoles, I just feel like each one of them has a distinct personality. Don't you think, Pat?
I agree. And the thing is that I would actually go on to say, I think that Sega gave other consoles personality, especially after them being gone. Like, I think if it weren't for Sega, I don't think we'd have an amazing sixth gen as we had before.
We were talking before the GameCube, right? So much of Sega kind of informed that kind of design language and that kind of personality. The GameCube was a console that had a lot of personality, I feel like, too. But there's a lot of Sega DNA in there.
Exactly, and that's sort of what I think. And yeah, I do think every Sega console, even down to the Pico, has its own personality, and that's what I really like about them, is that they all have their own vibes, their personality, their strengths, their weaknesses.
You look at a lot of their good games, and you realize they're Sega games, you know, like Super Monkey Ball or F-Zero GX, you know. It's just one of those things where you realize that Sega, that's one thing that they knew, is they knew what they're... I was talking to Brian on the beach, a month or two ago. Ooh. And he said, I know, right? We were on the beach at sunset. No, he said Sega was always a really reckless company. Careless or reckless? I don't know. But he wasn't saying it as a bad thing. He was saying, like, that was their personality.
Yeah, that's what gave them their charm.
Whereas Nintendo was very conservative, Sega just kind of was always a little reckless. And it was either for better or worse, you know? It was their greatest strength and also their greatest weakness, right? But I mean, the fact that they never turned away from that they were always true to that, kind of like careless, you know, trying everything, inventing where they could invent, you know, and creating games that were just oozing with charm. You mentioned Yakuza even has a charm to it. You keep using that word. And I think that is such a great word to try to encapsulate Sega, is this charm, like Nights into Dreams. You either love it or hate it, but you can't deny that it has this charm to it, you know, that makes it so unique and so different from any other gaming experience.
I was going to say there, Dave, who hates knights? Because I'll fight them.
You know, some people just don't care for it. But I really feel like the folks that don't just kind of probably don't get it, you know, because like it's not. Yeah, I mean, there is a Zen mode to that game and I feel the same way with like Sega Rally, for example. It's two totally different games, right? But I mean, I can get into that Zen mode. I'm hoping that other gamers know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
That mode where you just slip into almost a subconscious like nirvana of playing this game and getting your times better, and it sounds so cheesy when you say it, but it's almost like becoming one with the gaming mechanic, you know. It's such a well-made and well-crafted game that it's easy to become completely, you know, one with that mechanic and get better with it. And Sega Rally has it on the Saturn, and so does Knights. And they're completely different games, you know, but they both have that. Different teams, too, that develop them. But it's true to that kind of like... And there are other games like on the Dreamcast, like Jet Set Radio, that kind of have that, too, you know?
What I was going to say was Tony Hawk, because Brian once compared Knights to Tony Hawk as far as like the score attack. And
yes,
that's a Zen game for sure. And I never looked at it the same.
You're absolutely right. Tony Hawk is one of those rare examples of a Western title that was able to capture that mm-hmm. you know, that Western developers had a huge learning curve, you know, because Japanese game developers had such a jump start on them, you know, a lot of lessons learned and stuff like that. And so, and I mean, finally they caught up, but Tony Hawk was one of those examples. Yeah, it is.
I also feel like it's worth mentioning the through line and the way that legacy is recognized and carried on through indie developers today, mm-hmm. right? I mean, mm-hmm. I look at what games like, Hades as a, you know, I guess a beat 'em up reincarnate in a lot of ways, through a roguelike structure, taps into a lot of that kind of Zen flow. And, mm-hmm. you know, there's so many of, you know, just those trick attack and score attack kind of systems and mechanics that developers today are kind of moving that, or taking that torch that Sega, you know, really built up over the and lit during its heyday, and I do think there's a lot to love about you know, where we're at with the indie scene today, and, mm-hmm. and replicating mm-hmm. and getting some of that magic in its own right, in its own way. So mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe in some ways the legacies of the Saturn and Dreamcast kind of live beyond themselves.
Mm-hmm. They do. I think it's a good point with the ending scene, though, is that you brought up that I think a lot of those indie games are capturing that spirit. Like, I mean, yeah, you can't get big companies making those little games again, but you can get like smaller companies playing, making, oh, Bloodstained, A Hat in Time, or something like mm-hmm. that, or all these other niche games that we want to play, or like, oh, like a cyber, like Bomb Rush Cyberpunk, if we want, like Jet Set. Like, there's options mm-hmm. now to play these awesome indie games and not have to miss out on the era before. We can live six gen if we want.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You also have those games that maybe they don't have the zen that zen mode that I was talking about, but rather they have like a vibe going for them that is a, like, you as a gamer are just existing in this world and kind of being mm-hmm. able to. Examples of that I would say would be Shenmue or D2, you know, you're in the frozen Arctic and you're, you know, it's like, it's got so much atmosphere to it, you mm-hmm. know what I mean? And then, of course, on the Saturn, I would say, like, Lunacy, you know, is one of those games where you just kind of soak up that kind of atmosphere and it's a vibe, you know, as cliche as that sounds. I don't know, there aren't any better, you know?
Well, it is what it is. I think that's our current vernacular, but I think it's, you know, as we're developing the language to really
to be able hone to in
exactly what about the vibe that is appealing mm-hmm. to us. I think that's just kind of the first step. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Those games, yeah, I mean, those games Exhumed, are so much Power about Slave atmosphere.
Has yes. that pretty strongly. Yeah.
I mean, yes. There's so many. Lots of atmosphere. Yeah. In that game.
Deep Fear. Absolutely. I think it's one of its greatest.
Yes. Yes. You know what I mean? Like it's kind of like the tenseness that you would get in a hallway with an enemy and then the restfulness that you would get in like a, you know, the locker room where you can kind of like take a moment to breathe and
get your rocks, literally.
And then taking the surrounding atmosphere, you're in this like underwater research station and there's like noises kind of, you know, like ambient noises and stuff like that. It's just, you're rifling through filing cabinets, reading, autopsy reports and stuff like that. It's just, you know, it, even back then, it just like really did a lot to kind of put you in those shoes and kind of like allow you to kind of live that, you know.
Yeah. And to see the setting, you know, give that setting its own personality and have yes. it evolve in real time and kind of tell its own story just by virtue of, you know, when you go room to room and then you go back to places you visited before, it's like, oh, this is clearly, there's monsters here now, or this is very different. It's deteriorated. You could see how people lived before the mm-hmm. catastrophe. And then it kind of evolves as you play through the game. And so, yeah, I think that's something that maybe, you know, you see more of even in the AAA space now that I appreciate that games like
yes.
Deep Fear did really well back then. Mm-hmm. Resident Evil obviously did it as well.
Yeah. Unfortunately, a lot of the AAA has lost the memo as most of the games nowadays, especially on PlayStation or third-person over-the-shoulder shooters that are narrative-focused.
mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like Sonic Frontiers, for example, like there's a lot of good stuff going on there in the mechanics, but like
yeah.
as far as atmosphere, it just feels really cold. Yep.
That's how I feel about Power World more recently. I mean, just these games that have vast, dense environments that have plenty to do and interact with. And mm-hmm. that is at face value fun, as you know, there's a lot of enjoyment there, but at a certain mm-hmm. point, there's not a lot of breadcrumbs to give you a sense that it's a real place or that there's a reason for you being there. And
like what and I sometimes, want is I want to explore like a 3D spring yard zone, you know, like really explore with all those garish colors, you know, and mm-hmm. and like because I look at spring yard zone and I look into the background and I'm just like, well, I want to go there. Like I wish I could like explore this more, you know, and like I love and I mean, of course, Green Hill Zone been mm-hmm. done. But I mean, I feel like it's a lot of that stuff like Marble the Marble Zone and the Spring Yard Zone and even Starlight Zone. Like, I want to explore those environments more and vibe with that, you know? And but instead we get stuff that feels more like a knockoff of Breath of the Wild, but not in a good way. And so I'm not like completely... I love the fact that Sega is still trying, you know? I'm never going to fault them for, you know, continuing to try, because it's a lot better than just giving up and not trying, you know? But but I definitely want to see them move in the right direction. And I want them to realize what it is that fans love so much about their stuff and do more of that, you know?
Yeah, or empower those who are already seeking it and have the will to develop on their behalf, you know, give them the means to do that. And so I mean, you see, and I think Sega overall is better than most at that for all their faults.
Yeah. I have a lot of grace for them, you know, you kind of have to, cause you want to see them succeed, you know? And it's not, it's like saying, what would I do if I was the president? You know, like, I don't know that I really wouldn't want that job, to be honest with you. And so I know that there are a lot of difficult decisions to be made because it's a business. And at the end of the day, it has to be financially successful. But the fans, what the fans want and what the stockholder, the shareholders want are often not the same thing. You know,
well, hopefully with these new games that they're dropping, the views will change and be the same.
Yeah, exactly. You hope that what will be successful for the shareholders will also be successful for the fans, you know? That's when you get on a, you know, the kind of success that the Switch has, you know, for example, you know, like a lot of there's a lot of good first party and indie stuff happening on the Switch. And so there's this harmonious relationship, you know, I think with that, I want to see that kind of thing happen with the with Sega, you know?
I think that's probably a good place to leave it. Thank you all very much for joining us. And I know we could probably keep going on those threads for a while, and maybe we'll have to do another podcast that's focused on pulling at some of them.
It's been a fantastic conversation, guys. Thanks for coming on.
Definitely.
You know, we had a great time being on. We love the Dreamcast Junkyard, and we'd love to come on more often, have you guys on our show as well.
That needs to happen. Yeah, I love your stuff. So, you know, it's great that we managed to... I know, Pat, you were with us at Christmas, which was awesome, but, like, having you guys on to talk about what you've been doing and your great community and website was truly a pleasure. So thank you.
Yeah, so, I mean, so with all that, where can people find Shiro?
You can find us at SegaSaturnShiro.com. You can find us at PlaySegaSaturn on Facebook or SegaSaturnShiro. I think Twitter also our tags Play Sega Saturn at Play Sega Saturn, or I guess X. We're also on Blue Sky. I actually don't know what her name is on there. That's probably
Sega Saturn Shiro.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we're Sega Saturn Shiro on Blue Sky. But yeah, just look up those words, Sega Saturn Shiro, and you'll find us.
And we're also on YouTube as well. I forgot to mention. Probably should. That's probably the most important one.
Which is also Sega Saturn Shiro on YouTube.
Yeah.
We're a Discord community as well, and we wholeheartedly welcome anyone who wants to come be a part of our community to join. It's a fun environment, and it's a really welcoming and warm and inviting environment, you know, where we want folks to become a part of the conversation and contribute what they, you know, everybody contributes in a different way. So we appreciate the folks who are all about modding consoles and those who are all about tournaments and those who are about streaming, you know, so just come and be a part of the community.
I mean, I went in there recently and you, Dave, recommended me to buy Grid Runner. So that was a great reason to be
good
there.
Good game.
Yeah, good game. It is. Yeah. What are your individual socials?
So I'm Sega Saturn Dave on X or Twitter. Pretty much everywhere. Yeah, just look up Sega Saturn Dave, and you'll find me.
And I'm also just Traynoco, T-R-A-Y-N-O-C-O. I tweet about both Shiro. I have some videos on YouTube of just random tournament play and just the miscellaneous fun stuff. I also do another podcast called The Spirit Hunters, which is an anime podcast based on Yu Hakusho and Hunter x Hunter that I do occasionally. And that's a big one that I do. I have sort of a crossover audience, so I should have the links to both of those, or to my podcast at Spirit Hunter Pod, where I talk about that. So if you want to hear me talk about anime and stuff, I definitely recommend checking it out there with a whole other cast and crew. I don't think Dave's involved, or no one from Shiro's involved. It's just usually my friends from Arizona. So if you guys like anime and want to talk Hunter x Hunter, Yu Hakusho, or anything Togashi made, definitely hit us up.
Nice. And how about you, Lewis? Where are you at?
I am on Twitter at LewisJFC, and I basically just retweet the Junkyard stuff. I don't know if there's anything else I say, much of what I say on there, but you could check me out, and obviously you could check my writing up on the blog, which Brian will plug in a second. Where can we find you, Brian?
Good question. Trying to get on a plane so I can
yeah.
get to where Katie is. But anyway, yeah, so I am, in so much as I'm online at all, it's Twitter. I think I'm on as the Jet Brian Radio, at Jet Brian Radio. And then Blue Sky, I'm also on, probably the same name. And I do have my own personal blog that I haven't updated in a while, but that is thevirtuaplanet.com. And then I think with that, oh yeah, there's also the Titan Cast, which we do from time to time. And when we are able to record, I think more of us will be on the same time zone pretty soon. So I'm hoping they'll be a little easier to organize at that point. And then we got, of course, the Saturn Junkyard. You can check out the Facebook group and hang out with Simon and Cameron and all the cool people, and John, and everybody over there who makes that that community what it is. Otherwise, yeah, we got this Junkyard, the Dreamcast Junkyard, at the DC Junkyard on Twitter / X or whatever. And of course, our main blog is thedreamcastjunkyard.co.uk, which I write for time to time, as you do as well, Lewis. Mm-hmm. But a lot of cool contributions and voices, and just I feel like we've been firing on a lot of cylinders through that end of the year that we, you know, it's probably worth catching up on if you haven't visited in a while.
Yeah.
We do have a donation platform at buymeacoffee.com/DC Junkyard if you feel so inclined. I think we branded as Buy Me a VMU.
Yeah, buy me a VMU battery.
VMU battery. And then, I think we're on Facebook and YouTube. I don't know what those URLs are, but you can probably search. Yeah, I think Kev has been updating the YouTube stuff. And I think he most recently posted a review of the
Striker DC.
Yeah, Striker DC. Yeah. Anyway, with that, thank you all again for joining, and thank you for listening. I don't know, dream hard, play hard.
I love it.
Whatever.
That's the new one. That's the
dream
new
hard with a vengeance, people.
There we go.
Disc on a hi-fi or other audio equipment can cause serious damage to its speakers. Please stop this disc now.